And that person has an integral role in what's going on, but they're not named. But of course, who knows their name? And this is really, even without her name in the text being specified, we see immediately something about what the Lord thinks of her. So we see in John chapter 4 and in verse 8, the parenthetical statement for, verse 9, the parenthetical statement, for Jews have no dealings with Samaritans. Wednesday night, we looked at the first half of this encounter. What's behind that statement? Why was there a chasm between Jews and Samaritans? And why was there even hostility between Jews and Samaritans, especially prejudice towards Samaritans on the part of the Jews? Why?
They considered the Samaritans to be unfaithful and in some ways not genetically pure.
Right. Exactly. I think you identified two huge things there. They were mixed breed racially, including some evidence that there were Jewish blood mixed with them. But I think the biggest thing is that they had a mingled worship between some basis of worship of Jehovah, but then a mixture of serving their other gods too. And by the time you get to the New Testament, it was just a mash up of these things. And Jews really looked down on them and thought that they were, you know, not to be regarded, so to speak. And what geographic point did we make about the map Wednesday night that Jesus is breaking the norm? Right. Jews traveling between Judea and Galilee, which were two Jewish pockets, would usually go around Samaria and avoid it. Jesus had to go through it, as the text says. He must needs go through it. How does this meeting begin, and what's significant about it? How does the engagement start?
Well, Jesus starts it.
By doing what?
He says, he asks her to, he says, give me a drink.
He's asking a drink from her. She comes to the well with a water pot to get water. What's shocking about this encounter at first? She immediately reflects that it's shocking. What's shocking about it?
That he would be speaking to her as a Samaritan and a woman.
Yeah. So later on we see there's an issue about a man speaking to a woman in public. It's just about man, strange woman. But also this idea of a Jew speaking to a Samaritan. What do you have to do with me? And on top of just speaking to her and recognizing her as a person, he's actually putting himself at her disposal by saying, give me a drink. Which further shows that I'm not this superior one over you kind of thing. And so what is Jesus doing in very short order? Matter of fact, in the opening moments, what is he doing with this woman?
You made the point last Wednesday that he sat down at the well. It's kind of created more of a relaxing, more casual atmosphere between the two of them.
It was. I mean, he's opening a door with her, isn't he? And it is a very, the text makes note of those things. She's got the water pot. He doesn't have something to draw. He's sitting against the well. You really get a picture, don't you, of this scene. Very vivid picture. How does Jesus pivot the conversation from talking about drinking water from that well? How does he pivot it? He first talks about you giving me a drink from this well, and then how does he turn it? If you knew who's talking to you, you would ask me for the drink. But Jesus then takes the conversation to talking about not the water in Jacob's well, but a different kind of water. This reminds us of what conversation we just studied last week, where Jesus takes a physical reality and turns it into a spiritual truth.
Nicodemus,
in talking about birth, which is a very common thing, we've all been through it, but then really talked about a spiritual rebirth as Jesus is talking about spiritual water here. What big significant proclamation does Jesus make in verse 13? He makes two big significant proclamations. The first one is in verse 13. What is it? What bold claim does he make?
Drink physical water and you'll need to drink again.
That's right. If you drink this water, you'll need it again, but if you drink the water that I give, you'll never thirst. I mean, none of us know what kind of water that is. I mean, what kind of water is that? You drink it and you're never thirsty again. And according to verse 15, and this is getting down to where we left off, according to verse 15, by this point in the conversation, where is the woman in verse 15?
She's asking for the water.
She's asking for it. Matter of fact, what's been her demeanor in this conversation up to verse 15? Was she like passive and didn't care? Was she argumentative? Was she resistant? What characterizes how she responds to Jesus? Here she's finally asking, well, give me that water. Before that, what is she doing? Whenever he makes a statement, what is she doing? What'd you say?
She's very engaged in the conversation.
She's very connected to the conversation. She's with Jesus every step. I mean, all of a sudden, Jesus, they go from talking about water at Jacob's well to talking about the spiritual water where there's no thirst. I mean, that's a leap, right? I mean, that's a big jump. And she has to question, and she even challenges Jesus. But she's with Jesus every step of the way. I would propose to you, this is a very smart woman. Matter of fact, I think she's above average because a lot of people didn't get or didn't care to get what Jesus was trying to teach them. She's a quick learner. She really is. And so verse 15, maybe she doesn't understand everything about this, but there's no harm in asking, well, give me this water. Well, before he gives her the water, he has a question for her, and that's where we left off. So here in John chapter 4, we want to resume this here. And I want you to look in this section, verse 16 to 26. There are two revelations. Two revelations. One about the woman, and of course the other one, more importantly, is about Jesus. So, Zachary, are you free to read? Okay. Verse 16 to 26, please.
Jesus said to her, "Go call your husband and come here." The woman answered him, "I have no husband." Jesus said to her, "You are right in saying, 'I have no husband,' for you have had five husbands, and the one you now have is not your husband. What you have said is true." The woman said to him, "Sir, I perceive that you are a prophet. Our fathers worshipped on this mountain, but you say that in Jerusalem is the place where people ought to worship." Jesus said to her, "Woman, believe me, the hour is coming when neither on this mountain nor in Jerusalem will you worship the Father. You worship what you do not know. We worship what we know, but salvation is from the Jews. But the hour is coming, and is now here, when the true worshipers will worship the Father in spirit and truth, for the Father is seeking such people to worship him. God is spirit, and those who worship him must worship in spirit and in truth." The woman said to him, "I know that Messiah is coming, he who is called Christ. When he comes, he will tell us all things." Jesus said to her, "I who speak to you am he."
All right, thank you. Now, regarding how the conversation's been going, she just asked, you know, give me this water, like he asked her for water. But before that, Jesus tells her to call her husband. Now, there are a couple of junctures here where I have to be honest, for years, I didn't get the transition. They seem to be a jerk in direction. They're not. This is smooth as butter how this thing goes. This is fluid. It's all connected. It's very organic. Why did Jesus ask her to call her husband? What do you think? Yeah.
Well, she asks for the water in verse 15, but she's still thinking in terms of physical water. I won't have to come back here. I mean, she may think the water, there's something different about the water, but she's still thinking it's going to quench her physical thirst. She won't have to return to the well. So I think since she's not connecting all the dots, Jesus is going to get to the root of her problem, which is spiritual.
Right. Whatever Jesus does next with somebody is giving them the next step of teaching they need. We can operate on that principle. And she even references that in verse 15, so I don't have to come back here again. We know, and boy, we take that for granted or what? We got up this morning and turned on, we needed cold water to drink or hot water to bathe. Just right at the fingertips. Most people, in most of human history, the first thing they had to do most days is get up and fetch water. It's the life. And so, think about how many times she's probably had to do this. Unless you were so wealthy you could pay somebody to do it, okay? Think of how many times she had to do this. Was there another well that she kept going back to over and over again? Besides Jacob's well? From what we know about it?
Men.
Relationships. You know, I don't know what's got into people today. They just jump from husband or wives to wife. Well, humans always done that. You know why? They're thirsty. They're trying to quench thirst. The problem is they're going about it the wrong way, and they're not even addressing the real thirst they have. It's like you're thirsty for water and you go out and you chew on tree bark. It's not going to cut it. You need water, you need to drink it. And so, just like she had frequently visited wells, she frequently visited relationships. To the point where now she's got somebody and she's not even married to him. So, Jesus is offering a satisfaction that is eternal, a quenching of a spiritual thirst, while she's a prime candidate of a woman who kept going to wells and kept going to men to quench her thirst. She is quintessential human in her predicament. But Jesus is offering her a water, a way to quench an inner need, which is what her thirst is, an inner spiritual soul need. But that only comes from God. And so, as we know from John 2, Jesus asked this question because he already knew it, right? What proof does he show that he already knew her situation, even though he didn't know her, as far as interaction? Yeah, and what you've got now is not even your husband. He finishes the story, okay? And, you know, I have no husband, and she's like, well, you've had five husbands, and you do have a man now, but he's not even your husband. I mean, even that detail. I mean, it's incredible what he knows already about her. And that's why he brings that up. He brings that up because he knows that's an illustration, back to Earl's point of, okay, this is what I'm really talking about. Look at your water. Look at the well. Look at the men in your life. Do you see that you're not quenching your thirst? He's leading her to that point. Well, in verse 19, what happens? What's her admission? After the revelation about her husbands that Jesus already knew, in a way it's not a revelation. He knew it, she knew it. What happens in verse 19?
Jumps ahead in the conversation.
Yeah.
Oh, you're a prophet.
Yeah. She concludes you're a prophet. Is she off base on this? Absolutely not. Prophets oftentimes in the Old Testament did miracles or predicted the future, so they had some kind of miraculous knowledge. Not every prophet, but it did happen in the Old Testament. Yeah.
The other thing the prophets did was talk about the path.
Yeah.
They were able to precisely say what has already happened.
Yes. Matter of fact, the prophets said more about the past than the future. They interpreted the past for Israel. This is what happened. This is what you did. This is what God's doing with you. That kind of thing. But boy, what a miraculous understanding of the past Jesus has to know this woman's history without having ever interacted with her on a physical basis. So her conclusion that he's a prophet, she's not off base. Here, off base here. It's like Nicodemus came to Jesus and said, you know, no one can do the signs you're doing unless you're from God. He's on the right track. She's getting this. Jesus revealed this miraculous knowledge to try to reveal to her who he was. She got it. Again, she's a quick study. And it's not just her intelligence, which we emphasized a while ago. It also is her disposition about things. It's her attitude about things. And then in verse 20, immediately what does she do? You're a prophet. And then in verse 20, what does she bring up?
They ask about worship. Resolve this issue.
Okay. Okay. Since you're a prophet, I'm a little behind my PowerPoint. It's not very more in my head. I'm so caught up in the study that, yeah. So she brings up an issue. And this is where, for the longest time, I thought, well, she's changing subjects. She's trying to get on something else. She's trying, you know, he got on a sensitive spot, the husband's. So she's trying to shift the conversation. Or is this a sincere inquiry? Because this would have been a chief issue between Jews and Samaritans. Who had the right worship? Our worship is different from yours. We think we're the true keepers of the flame. You think you're the true keepers of the flame. So sort this out, like you say. Because after all, you're a prophet. It's not that far, it's not that far-fetched that she would go there. Because that would be a common point of discussion between Jew and Samaritan. And not only that, this is already out about the husbands. What more does she have to hide, kind of thing? So I'm not so sure it's a dodge. She may realize I've got somebody who may have some answers. Yeah.
I also thought about this in the context of I've had coworkers and people come up to me and ask, if you had a chance to pray to God or talk to God face to face, what would you ask him? And it strikes me as this woman's like, wait, I'm confronted with somebody who could actually answer one of those questions.
Yeah.
And she has something to mind that she's interested in.
I mean, really, if you dissect this thing and you're like, this is a Samaritan woman who realizes this is a man with miraculous knowledge, this would be near the top of the list to ask. Especially a Jewish prophet, obviously. So I would have you see that this conversation is fluid. It's not herky-jerky. It's fluid. Matter of fact, ultimately, it is such a dichotomy between believing that humans have free will, but yet God is overall in control. It's a little bit of a paradox, maybe a lot of a paradox. I think the conversation is going exactly where Jesus wants it to go. And by saying what he said so far, he's guiding it that way. He's prodding it in that direction, just like a shepherd prodding the sheep to turn and go this way. So let's talk about this. Let's talk a little bit about Samaritan worship versus Jewish worship. Let's make some comparisons here and contrasts. What do you know? We talked a lot about this Wednesday night, actually a lot about it. So let's contrast Samaritan worship and Jewish worship. The first thing she admits is what? What's the difference?
The Mount
Where?
Gerizim.
Location. Jerusalem or Mount Gerizim. And that's true. The center of worship were in those two different places, and Jews or Samaritans would congregate in those places for certain worship, ceremonies and rituals. What else is different? And this sort of comes up with Jesus' response to her. It has to do with origins. What was the origin of Jewish worship? Where did they get their activities?
The Old Testament.
The law of Moses. The law. The revelation from God through Moses. Where did the Samaritans get their worship? What was the origin of their worship?
Pentateuch.
Yep. They did rely on law, the law of Moses, and what else? We read passages about this in the Old Testament. What did they mingle with the law?
Worship of their own gods.
Pagan worship of their gods from the lands they originally came from. So Samaritans were populated into the northern part of Israel after the Assyrians captured the northern kingdom, deported most of the Israelites, repopulated the land with people from different places around the Tigris-Euphrates Valley. And when they got back there, they combined the two, the pagan religion and Jewish religion. So their origins are very, very different. completely different there.
Philip?
Yes.
The reason I actually said the Pentateuch is because, the first five books don't give the location.
They kind of date.
When you think about it.
Yep.
And numerous other details that they would need to know.
Yeah. Yeah, a lot of the temple worship that they knew in New Testament times had come from David and Solomon's time, hadn't it? The temple, the location, the temple, the organization around, sons of Korah and all that. They only accepted the five books of the law, not the rest of the Old Testament scriptures. And they had thrown in all these pagan rituals and superstitions with that. So it's really a mashup there. What two things does Jesus state in verse 23 in responding to her? One thing he says about time. What does he say about time? She's wanting to know, where's the right place to worship? What's his reference to time?
It's about to change.
It's changing. The hour is coming, and then he says later, and now is, where neither place matters. And then he says something about the action of worship. What does he say? Regarding this change that's coming, what does he say about the action of worship?
In spirit and in truth.
So in contrast to where you're at, that doesn't matter. What matters is worshiping in spirit and in truth. And then he says something. He recognizes that the origin of the Jewish religion was true knowledge in verse 22, right? You worship what you do not know, we worship what we know, for salvation is from the Jews. This is showing that the Jewish lineage of worship and revelation was from God. The Samaritans had been corrupted. I mean, he doesn't try to win a friend here by being, by compromising truth at all. But what he's saying is that's the past. Now's a new day. And look what he says in verse 23. What does he say at the end of verse 23 about the Father?
Seeking.
The Father seeking what?
Such people to worship.
Those true worshipers. I think this is the key passage of the whole story. Why? The Father is seeking. That's not a theoretical statement. The Father is seeking these true worshipers. How is this the key statement of the whole text, probably?
Because it means that the differentiation of the Jew and the Samaritan was no longer going to be under this new way of worship.
Right.
Those identifications were not going to matter.
Completely irrelevant to the true worshiper. And what? Go ahead, Earl.
It's also not about where you worship. It's about how you worship, and it's about relationship.
Exactly.
God's relationship with each individual person.
Right. Exactly.
And he's telling this woman she can be one.
Why would he be talking about it this way? He's teaching her how to be a true worshiper. You know what he's doing? He's seeking her as a true worshiper. This whole account is the Father seeking true worshipers. The Father sent the Son, and the Son is going to find true worshipers. Why does he say to this woman, as he's leaning against this well in the heat of the day, why does he look at her and say, give me water to drink? That was his first opening statement, to seek her as a true worshiper. And it's a Samaritan woman who had a stable full of husbands, who's living with a man.
Why did he go to Samaria in the first place?
Why did he even go there to begin with? Looking for true worship. Samaria is the last place that a devout Jew would look for true worshipers. But the hour is coming, you see. When it doesn't matter whether you're Jewish or Samaritan or on Mount Gerizim or in Jerusalem.
And now it is.
And it's now. She's looking at that hour. And we got plenty of time. I keep saying this. We have plenty of time to explore evangelism, okay? But I would have you take this text and cherish it and file it away and cling to it and meditate on it. It's critical to understanding evangelism. And we'll make a couple references here in a moment to that. So here's the other great truth, you know, that Jesus makes here. The hour is coming now. Here we go. Okay. The true worshipers will worship the Father in spirit and truth. He has two great statements in this discourse with this woman. One is, I've got the water that if you drink it, you'll never thirst. And second of all, true worshipers worship in spirit and truth. And the Father's looking for those. He's seeking those. And what is he talking about here? Worship in spirit. I think that's a contrast to the location. It's spiritual worship. You don't have to physically be in a certain place. Mankind always wants to nudge worship toward physical space. You got to be at a certain place, and you're trying to cultivate a certain atmosphere, and there has to be a certain decorum and a certain architecture. And somehow, the physical imposes upon the soul the mood of worship. And this is a trend. This is a trend. I mean, just look at, loosely saying, Christianity from the time of the book of Acts to the medieval cathedrals. Humans want to gravitate toward creating physical space to impose worship disposition. Jesus is saying it's the opposite. It starts from within. You worship in spirit, okay? It's a spiritual thing, not a physical thing. And in truth, which has to be this idea that he's referencing there at the Samaritans, this has to be revealed from God. This has to be guided by God. It's not guided by superstition. It's not guided by cultural tradition. It's not guided by personal preference. Worship is guided by truth. Any worship that's not guided by truth is not true worship. And where does truth come from? Comes from God. He has to reveal it to us. And this is such a modern text. And I don't even want to say modern text. It's such an eternal text. Because look at the morality of this woman trying to quench her thirst. And look at the culture she's living in and how they were worshiping. They had taken a little bit of this. It's just like cafeteria eating. You take a little bit of this, you put that on your tray, you put that on your tray, you put that on your tray, and this is what I like. I like a little bit of this, a little bit of that, a little bit. This is what I like. This is not a modern thing. This is a human thing. They did it in the Old Testament. People do it today. It's an always thing. It's not like, well, people in America today, they just want to. No, it's people, period, have always done this. And so her moral life and her religious bent, she's the woman of all ages. And Jesus is trying to guide her and save her. He's seeking her. And then when he reveals about this hour is coming and worshiping the Father in spirit and truth, she responds back. And this is the last thing she says to Jesus. What does she say to Jesus? In verse 25, what does she bring up? Again, is she changing subjects, or is this all flowing together? What does she bring up? Verse 25. The
Messiah.
The Messiah. And she even said, look at her language. I know that Messiah is coming. When he comes, he will tell us all things. Jesus had just said, the hour is coming, and now is. So it seems like this is prompted by Jesus saying there's an hour that's coming where there's a change. And she says, well, we know the Messiah is coming. And he will tell us all things. Well, the reality is, he's already told her. Yeah, go ahead.
But also the comparison of he earlier was saying, you worship what you do not know.
Mm-hmm.
I know the Messiah is coming. He'll explain that.
Okay. There's what she does know. And she is on track on that knowledge. She's spot on in that knowledge. And then here is the other big revelation. The first big revelation to us readers is about her past, which is not a revelation really to her or to him. And then here's the second big revelation, which is to her, which is what? Verse 26.
I who speak to you am he.
How often does Jesus do this in his ministry? Rare. Matter of fact, other times he does something like it, he's not quite as explicit as it says. Of all people, of all places. I mean, why her? There is a pattern with Jesus the more hostile a person was to him, the more closed-minded they were, Herod would be the prime example, the less he sent him. So what do we conclude with the weight of the gospel evidence? What are we to conclude about this woman and Jesus, the fact that he said this to her, "I'm the Messiah"? What's it say? She's a vessel ready for it. Like you say, fertile soil, that's where you put that seed.
The gospel is for all men.
Yeah. I mean, that's not who most people would have thought the Messiah would have said this to. And it's in private. Why not on the rooftops? Hey, let's forget this. Let's forget trying to figure out why God does things the way he does. He's God. We're not going to figure that out. We may figure some things out. But we have to just resign ourselves. He's God. And it doesn't make sense to us, right? Why Jesus doesn't do more of this and more publicly. He gets pretty close to the Sanhedrin when he references, you know, the Son of Man, where he said to those kinds of things. But this is so, so clear, okay? So minimal, so private, so out of the way, but so effective with this woman. So effective. And we see immediately the effect, don't we? So let's look here at what happens next. Well, I am just really doing a bad PowerPoint, John. This is like a D-minus on PowerPoint you see that. sorry about that. Let's look at the follow-up here and the outcomes here, the implications. Starting in verse 27. Tristan, can you read verse 27 down to verse 42 for us, please?
And at this point, his disciples came, and they marveled that he talked with a woman. Yet no one said, "Why do you seek?" or "Why are you talking with him?" The woman then left her water pot, went her way into the city, and said to the men, "Come see a man who told me all things I ever did. Could this be Christ?" Then they went out of the city and came to him. In the meantime, his disciples urged him, saying, "Rabbi, eat." But he said to them, "I have food to eat of which you do not know." Therefore, the disciples said to one another, "Has anyone brought him anything to eat?" Jesus said to them, "My food is to do the will of him who sent me, and to finish his work. Do you not say, 'There are still 4 months, and then comes the harvest'? Behold, I say to you, lift up your eyes and look at the fields, for they are already white with harvest. And he who reaps receives wages, and gathers fruit for eternal life, that both he who sows and he who reaps may rejoice together. For in this the saying is true, 'One sows and another reaps.' I sent you to reap for that which you have not labored. Others have labored, and you have entered into their labors." And many of the Samaritans of that city believed in him because of the word of the woman who testified, "He told me all I ever did." So when the Samaritans had come to him, they urged him to stay with them. And he stayed there 2 days. And many more believed because of his own word. Then they said to him, "Now we believe, not because of what you said, but we ourselves have heard him, and we know that this is indeed the Christ, the Savior of the world."
All right, thank you very much. Let's talk about the outcomes here. From this conversation, what do we see about the woman? What happens? Two actions she takes. She immediately runs into the town and starts telling people what she's found and heard. She's with him every step. She has realized the magnitude of what she's discovered. And the other thing, where I say the other thing she did, it's not so much two things she did. There's one thing she didn't do. What'd she leave behind?
Water.
Symbolism is just dripping in this text. She left the water pot, the water jar she brought with her. I mean, it's like, you ever done one of those things? Yes, I do it all the time. You know, I go to get water, and then I come back, and I'm like, I didn't even get the water. I forgot to get the water, okay? But that's just human, you know, mismemory kind of thing. Her mind's on something else now. And you know what? Water's pretty basic to what people needed and how they had to get it. And the fact that she's let that water pot go, it's a great contrast to the sermon today, actually. She's found something so much better than a pot of water. And so she tells everyone. And what's so funny, the authenticity of the message, all that I ever did, you know, it's not very complimentary what she shares. He's telling me all about those husbands I've had. That's what she's referencing. And it's not complimentary. It's like the record of the four Gospels, which are built upon the testimony of the apostles, Matthew and John being two apostles, and oftentimes those Gospels are very complimentary of the apostles. But that's okay, because they're proclaiming the truth here. What about the disciples? Two things perplex the disciples. What were they? They immediately see he's doing what when they walk up? Talking with this woman. They marvel at that. Why are you talking with this woman kind of thing? And then the other thing they're perplexed by is they've been on an errand, and then they come back, and what perplexes them in verse 31, 32, and 3?
Jesus doesn't want anything to eat. He was famished and they left.
We went to get food for you, now you don't even want the food. This is similar. She left the water pot. Now he's not interested in eating because he's found a woman that's open to Christ. He's found someone that could be a true worshiper. It's better than food. And so he talks about that. I got food to eat that you don't know. It's the idea of focus on his work. And this is when Jesus casts a vision. At this moment, when this happens with this one woman, although at the time she's going back into town and telling everyone, what vision does he have here that he paints? What picture does he see?
Fields ripe for harvest.
Right. He sees Samaria as a bountiful harvest. Certainly other people wouldn't think that, would they? And then the Samaritans, what happens with them? They respond to her and they come and check this out. And what's their conclusion?
Well, initially they believe because of what she said, but then they come to listen themselves and believe because of what they heard.
Right. And we don't have a direct link except that the next time Samaria is mentioned is in Acts chapter 8 when Philip goes to preach in Samaria. And it's clear from that text there is a significant response to the gospel there. We know that Jesus also passes through Samaria at other times, and some places don't receive him well and other places do. I think this is found in Luke. But as New Testament students, we can't help but to tie the line between John 4 and Acts 8. Because Jesus is prepping people. He's getting people ready. And then they receive the preaching of the kingdom in Acts chapter 8 and Philip. So the Samaritans here are responding. This is a really positive outcome. They're responding to him, and they're open to him. And one example for us that Jesus lays out here, to look for the spiritual thirst in people. But to see the spiritual thirst in people, what must we do according to this example?
Confront them with their sin.
We got to see where their sin is. Because their sin is linked to that spiritual thirst, isn't it? What sin is, we're talking about sin is missing the mark, exactly right. It's missing the mark. You're trying to satisfy yourself this way when God says there's a better way. It's my way.
We need to see everyone as a healthy candidate for the gospel.
You got to overlook gender. You got to overlook culture. You got to overlook their religious past. You got to overlook their moral past. You got to see them as a potential being a true worshiper of God. All those things are easily dealt with. And I mean easily. All those things can be dealt with. Their moral past, their religious confusion. If somebody's sincere and honest, they'll get to where they need to be. It takes time, it takes teaching, it takes patience. But that's doable. Jesus sees her as a great candidate for the gospel. Who would have saw that? Nobody else would have. Jesus sees a harvest when other people don't, and we've got to. And I'm going to throw these three points up together because I think they belong together. And that is, he shows an unconventional respect for her and how he deals with her. even just by saying, give me a drink, and an unexpected interest in her. Why are you talking to me? The disciples, why is he talking to her? You know, that's the refrain there. And the lesson is, talk to the people you're not supposed to talk to. Can you generate a list of people you're not supposed to talk to? Asheville has a reputation, I understand. So, talk to them anyway. Everybody knows exactly what I'm talking about. Talk to them anyway. You want Asheville full of Samaritan women with empty water pots? It's exactly what it's full of. And so is D.C. and New York and Atlanta and Chattanooga. It's all Samaria. Come on. People with religious confusion and moral baggage. Talk to them anyway. They're a Muslim? Talk to them. They're an atheist? Talk to them. They're a homosexual? Talk to them. And here's the point. Jesus made very simple statements here to try to steer the conversation toward the spiritual. At any point, she could have walked off and it would have been, you know, give me water to drink. Well, you know, why are you talking to me? I'm a Samaritan. And he says, well, if you knew who was talking to you, you'd ask him for water. And then she walks off. She gets her water, snubs him, and walks off. So, but she doesn't. Simple statements. Now, later on, he gets heavy in what he says. But it just starts with some simple statements, trying to steer the conversation toward the spiritual. To talk about God, to talk about our souls, to talk about eternity. Just simple statements. What do you think about this? What are your thoughts? What are your experiences? Just try to ignite the conversation, and possibly it can accelerate, and look what this led to. It's just starting a conversation and trusting in the providence of God that through that conversation, God is seeking true worshipers. All right, thank you very much.